everybody, and welcome to episode 44 of the epic Vassals of Kingsgrave, A Song of Ice and Fire linear reread. Today we're still in A Storm of Swords, and we're going to be covering the events from the 15th to 17th of November 299, and that's the chapters Cat 5, Bran 2, Arya 5, and Arya 6. I'm your host tonight. My name's Bina 007 on the forums of a podcast of Ice and Fire, which is where you can find us if you want to get involved. Today, I'm joined by some of our Cockney Moot brethren. I'm joined by Joe.
Hi all, Joe here. Jaysar on the forums.
Good to see you. And I am joined by honorary Cockney, Varley.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, we drafted him in.
I mean, hello, governor.
Cool, by me. I'm joined by genuine Cockney, not really, but Noah.
Hello, guys. Noah in real life, pops 88 on the forums.
And the reason for the most recent Cockney meet, we are joined by Valkyrist on the forums, who's actually in England right now. Hey, Duncan.
Woo! Yeah, calling in from sunny England. Yeah, it's Duncan or Valkyrist on the forums.
Yeah, so we all met up with also the podcast Bard, Nadine on the forums, Tedard, last Sunday for a really cool Cockney meet, at which the podcast Bard serenaded Duncan. That was quite something. And Tanya.
It was great. I got it on film, so I'll post it to the forum when I get back.
Fantastic. He did basically a song in honour of Duncan to the tune of Valerie, which was very cool.
It was pretty amazing.
And we were also joined at the Cockney Moot by Tanya. Hey, Tanya.
Hi, this is Tanya, Silence on the forums.
So, super. So our real and authentic and not so authentic Cockneys are all in place. We are going to cover the chapters I mentioned before. We're going to spoil all published works in A Song of Ice and Fire, potentially, but we won't be covering stuff from Game of Thrones. If you're not watching, you won't be spoiled. Okie dokie. So in the last episode, we left events with Dany entering Meereen, or sort of on the road to Meereen, and Dany 5, wondering how she's going to get in. We now move forward one day to the 15th of November 299. The events of this chapter actually take place over 8 days, so it does move forward. But to do this, we jump back 14 chapters or 150 pages. So this is an episode where we're really going to be moving back and forth across the book. And I believe it's Joe who's got a summary.
Indeed, yes. So in this chapter, we follow Cat along on her happy and relaxed journey towards Riverrun from the Twins. Well, from Riverrun towards the Twins, rather. We're going for Edmure's wedding to Roslyn. Apart from a few of his close friends, most of the River Lords are staying behind to defend their lands. So it's a largely northern army that Rob is leading. Not with them is Jane Westerling, who, after several attempts, has been left behind to stay at Riverrun at Cat's urging, because they don't want to antagonise the Freys any further. Although, as we're aware, the Freys don't really need any more antagonising. Also missing, we have only one of the other Westerlings, so we've just got Sir Reynald. The rest have been left behind in various places. With the party, we have the completely not sinister Lame Lothar Frey. I'm really not sure if it's the fact he is actually written sinisterly, or it's just the fact we know what he's involved with that makes me think he's being sinister when he's.
Well, did you think he was sinister the first time you read it? Can you remember that?
Well, I remember struggling a bit with this chapter and feeling it was quite oppressive, sort of the whole atmosphere. But I couldn't tell you if I thought Lame Lothar was was particularly sinister.
Particularly up to no good. Okay.
It's the fact that he's a nice Frey that makes him even more sinister than the rest of them.
Because we now know more about the Freys.
Yeah. So I didn't think that made him sinister, because I thought, well, you know, Tyrion's a nice Lannister and he's you know, quote unquote crippled. So maybe every shitty family has the good guy who's got some physical disability, and that's how it works.
Sure.
In Westeros.
That's true. Yeah.
We'd seen at this point, like, I think we'd seen the Freys at Harrenhal sort of running over the Stark banners. I think Arya sees them sort of throwing a strop and leaving. I can't remember. I think that must be before this. Anyway, to continue, we do not have the Blackfish with us. He's been left behind to hold Riverrun as the new warden of the Southern Marches. Cat thinks about how if anyone could hold it, he will. But we know how long he does hold it until Jaime turns up in Feast. So Grey Wind is particularly agitated this whole time, sort of noticeably on edge and running up and down, which sort of helps to set the tone for the chapter, really. It's quite tense, or it feels such, with the sort of very somber rainfall the whole time. It's grey and drizzly and horrible. So a lot of this chapter is sort of intermittent scenes of Kat on this, as Bina said, 8-day journey. So first of these we come across is her and Daisy, where Daisy tells Kat about how, you know, their force is in a stronger position than it seems, because Rob has won every battle, which is the thing everyone seems to know about Rob. And then Kat thinks somewhat early that it's true that he's won every battle, but he seems to have lost everything else, which a little bit of foreshadowing. The route takes them through a slightly autumnal whispering wood about 11 months after the battle, and then Kat reflects on and has a bit of wishful thinking, where she thinks about how much better things would be if Theon had died in place of Karstark's sons. And then we get even more rain and even more unpleasant weather and just general drudgery. And we hear from Galbert Glover, who's leading the Outriders, that all the close by bridges have basically been washed away. And they decide they have to go around the Blue Fork, which is going to involve going through sort of areas with no roads and marshes. And it's going to take, you know, a couple of weeks longer. And
it's almost as if nature's giving them a hint, isn't it? Like, don't go further. Well, it's not worth it. The rivers are rising. They're telling you something.
Well, no, the thing about the chapter is clearly no one wants to go where they're going, and it's just such, they're having such a horrible time. And it sort of sticks out. And then we get the note that I think in hindsight is more important, but that Roose Bolton will beat them there because by several days, because he's going to be able to use the King's Road.
I'd like to think that the Freys weren't planning a red wedding right now, and it was because of the rains and they're delayed. They're like, these motherfuckers are taking forever. Fuck it. Let's like kill them all.
Straw.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Roose persuades them when he arrives.
Exactly.
Cool. So the next stop off we have is at Old Stones, where by a sort of weather-beaten statue of an old king, Catelyn relates the story of said king, who is Tristopher the Fourth of House Mud, who is one of the last First Men kings of the Riverlands, and who, in a sort of analogy to Rob, won 99 of his battles against the Andal invaders before dying in his 100th, and his kingdom collapsing around him with a weak succession in place. And this story leads on to talk of Rob's succession, with Kat going off on some family history, talking about how Rickard had no siblings, but his dad had a sister who married someone in the Vale, who has daughters who's married into houses in the Vale, which Rob kind of dismisses and promotes the idea of legitimizing Jon Snow, which Kat sort of vehemently objects to, citing, you know, Night Watch vows and the history of the Blackfyres causing issues for the Targaryens for, you know, five generations after being legitimized, which just pisses Rob off, really, because he just wanted her to agree with him. Catelyn, again on the road, is talking to Mage and Daisy Mormont about sort of the martial prowess of the Mormont women, and they talk about how, because for centuries they've been fighting off Ironborn and Wildlings, that they have a very different idea of sort of a woman's role in society than, say, Lynes Hightower, who Jorah brought back after they got married, and they sort of very sneery and dismissive of Southern women. Towards the end of the chapter, we get Jason Mallister showing up, and we learn the news that a certain Balon Greyjoy has died, and Euron has appeared on the same day, which sort of, you know, sends Rob and the rest into a kind of big planning spree about how they're going to...
Is that first mention of Euron, like, properly appearing in Westeros again?
Yes, Theon mentions him earlier, but this is the first appearance.
It's about a week after it happens, isn't it?
Feels momentous, isn't it? These last few episodes, we've had Qyburn introduced, and now we've got, you know, all these characters that are going to be have ramifications.
And I feel like one of Theon's POVs in like the first or second book, like he mentions like Victarion and Euron, and then we don't really see him proper until Feast for Crows. So that's like, it's like, well, some 3D level chess stuff.
So the Blackfyres aren't mentioned in this book, I don't think.
Yeah, book two, I think they're mentioned, because Victarion's at the feast where Theon is in book two, but I think Euron's only mentioned, obviously, because he's in exile.
Yeah.
But he really seems like one of those characters that we don't really expect to see, because we hear about so many characters that are missing in some way, and they just never show up, and he just sounds like he would be one of those, and then he does actually turn up, so that's quite
interesting. Let alone if you read the Winds of Winter preview chapter, someone who could potentially, as we go into the final third of this book series, become so influential.
Yeah. He's a new Ramsay Bolton.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been set up as the baddie, I think.
Or even well, more bigger. He's Cthulhu, right?
it looks like he is.
Vote the greater evil.
Yeah. So Euron's back and leads to them coming up with plans. And then we get the scene that spawned a thousand theories, really. We get the scene in the tent where Jon sends off Galbert Glover and Major Mormont to go and find Howland Reed as part of his sort of idea for a three-pronged attack on Moat Cailin, with, you know, a feint to the south and then north and west, surprise assaults. And then, importantly, he gets all the lords who are there to affix their seals to this this writ naming his heir, who we sort of assume is John. That's how the chapter ends. Yeah, I have one question for you all. Do we think that Rob really had a choice but to name John as his heir? Given, I think in the chapter he outlines that, you know, next in line is Sansa, who's married to Tyrion, and he thinks his other brothers are dead. So do we think he had a choice apart to name John?
What other choice does he have? Of course he has a choice, but like, what is the worst choice? Like that Vale person that he's just finding out about, or like someone that he's grown up with?
Yeah, it makes total sense, I think.
Right?
Yeah, it has to. Yeah, he really does have no other choice.
Well, that's like, not strictly true. I mean, he can do what Kat says and get a legitimate but sort of lesser house, you know, like a cadet house heir, but someone who isn't familiar with the ways of Ned Stark. So from his perspective, he has no choice.
All right, so potentially what would happen if he, say, named Harrion Karstark his heir, for example, you know, so, and brought one of the major houses that rebel against him back into the frame?
It'd just be like one big awkward.
Yeah, a little bit.
Or could he have named like someone who isn't a cadet house but just is a strong northern family? I mean, just pick out the Manderleys and say, okay, you know, you're going to take that on.
No, because I think the whole North thing is like there's always been a Stark in Winterfell. Winterfell, like, you know, to have...
So it,
like,
has to be a Stark.
Yeah, and as far as everyone knows, Jon Snow is as close to a Stark as we can get to a Stark.
It also struck me reading this chapter that of all the people who make an attempt to find Arya, you know, at some point, Kat does questionable things to get her daughters back. You've got Brienne sent on a mission, but he never ever makes an attempt really to get his sisters back, or especially Arya. Like, he doesn't, I mean, I know it's like finding a needle in a haystack, but he's just very coolly, I mean, maybe that's a good thing, and maybe it's pragmatic. He just writes them off. They're off the table now.
Maybe he just really doesn't know what he could possibly be doing, which is, maybe there's just so much going on that he has to focus on that he kind of doesn't.
I think Arya's unfair. Arya's very unfair, because the last he heard of her was that she got lost in before Ned passed away so dearly.
Yeah, she got like kind of lost when the coin flipped on the Starks, right?
Yeah. She was. I mean, once Ned went, she was gone as well.
And right, she was in the crowd watching.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we know that, but for all they know, she could have been trampled in some sort of riot. Taken into some brothel somewhere. God knows what happens to young girls in King's Landing.
Yeah,
I think they all assume he was just killed when the Starks got taken out.
But it's interesting because he was sort of, in book two, he seemed to be under the impression that the Lannisters had both sisters, but now he seems to have accepted that Arya's disappeared. I guess because they've heard things about Sansa,
yeah,
but
exactly.
Not Arya.
Because if
maybe the news...
Because surely they would have, if not married Arya off, they would have betrothed her to someone useful to them if she were alive.
Absolutely. Well, she was betrothed to one of the Freys. Wasn't that part of the marriage pact with Rob?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the one
she meets him as well. Yeah.
And I mean, the Lannisters sort of betrothed fake Arya off to the Boltons, so they're still under that ruse. But it's strange that he seems to have accepted it, even though he has no evidence that she's been lost.
But he's super pragmatic at this point, because the other thing he assumes, which had never occurred to me and doesn't actually happen so far, is that as soon as Sansa marries Tyrion, that as soon as she gives birth to a son, they'll kill Sansa, that they only want the heir.
Yeah.
That they won't even just keep her around, even just for sort of iconic wheel her out of public things to pacify the North. I mean, surely...
Do you think that would be true?
I think they would keep her alive, even if for very much... constrained and under house arrest, because if the North ever rises up, she's a very useful kind of iconic figure. But he's just he's gone super ruthless. He's like, no, Arya's dead. Sansa's as good as dead as soon as she gives birth to a son. Move on. And maybe he doesn't truly believe that, but he's trying to convince his mum, so he has to go melodramatic in the reasoning.
Right, because I think we get something from like Cleos Frey in one of the Cat chapters where she's like, you know, he keeps on mentioning Sansa and how good she was looking, but no mention of Arya. So that, I think that really kind of gave the impression that Arya wasn't there. So that therefore she must be dead.
Yeah, but I mean, Kat thinks, you know, she's a willful child. Maybe they've just locked her in a room or something.
Yeah, I agree. I'd like to believe in that, but I feel that knowing who Arya is and how the Lannisters would have treated her, she's probably kept, you know, under lock and key somewhere, if that's where she is kept at all.
Do you think so? I mean, they are pretty brutal. I mean, Edmure is basically in the same kind of situation that Sansa would be in if she gave birth to, like, you know, Tyrion's kid, right? Like, they're just waiting for his son to be born so they can off him. Like, and Jaime,
but that's absurd, because you don't need to wait for the father to be born to off to get the offspring, right? You could have done that already.
How it works, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I guess also with Sansa, I mean, particularly in that kind of world, we don't hear that much about babies dying or whatever. But presumably they would have a very high infant mortality rate. So even having an heir born doesn't guarantee you that the heir will be around for that long. So even for that very probatic reason,
exactly,
it makes sense to keep the woman around and also as a very valuable hostage. So.
Yeah, and that's my point about Arya. If the Lannisters had Arya, even if they kept her under lock and key because she was a mischievous and seditious little shit from their perspective, you still have to announce that you have her, because the value of the hostage, the value of the pressure you can put on your opponent is shown that you have a prize that they want. You wouldn't have her and not tell everyone you had her.
Yeah, and you can still betroth her to someone.
Exactly. It's like a nuclear warhead. You need to tell people you have it, otherwise it's pointless.
Yeah, I don't think the Lannisters would have killed her because they needed the loyalty of the Northerners. So they needed a Stark figurehead. They needed Sansa there.
Exactly.
Being treated well. But I think it is a kind of, it's such a brutal thing for Rob to say to Catelyn, because she's, I mean, I think everyone else has accepted that her children are dead. I mean, she's still clinging on to it, but he kind of has to just let go of them and say, all right, this is the situation we're in. You know,
right,
it's a really bad situation, but we have to deal with the pieces we have.
But then
like, in an ideal world, yes, I could name Sansa as my heir, but she's currently married to Tyrion Lannister, so I can't do that. Like,
yeah, doing nothing ensures that Tyrion would inherit Winterfell,
right.
And Jon Snow is easily the closest thing to a Stark. He was raised by Ned Stark.
I do have some sympathy with Kat. I mean, obviously, Kat doesn't like Jon, so she's going to use every argument in the book.
Kat and I should be friends.
But the one I do, you should be. But the one argument,
you're too smart, Kanye.
No, I think Kat is smart, because the point about the Blackfyre Rebellion is a good one. That you're making John your heir just in case you die in the war. But what if you survive? What if Jane has an heir? And then John, meanwhile, has been legitimized. You can't delegitimize him. So then you do set up a conflict of the generations. Now, evidently, because we know that Rob gets killed, we think, well, that's, you know, a fine problem. We'll worry about the problem when we get to it. But I actually think it's a really sensible argument.
I think we had this argument on the other thing. It's like the other side of the coin is the Starks just die out because you did nothing. Like, you don't have a son, you don't have an heir, you didn't legitimize John. So, like, you're ensuring, like, you know.
The decree happened, would be if Rob died and he left no heir. Like, so it wouldn't be Rob against John.
I do hate the whole, oh, look at the Blackfyres, and for that reason all bastards are treacherous and they're all tainted blood. You know,
it's just Catelyn's just warped perception of John.
No. I don't think the Blackfyre thing is about bastardy. I think the problem at all, I mean, maybe for Catelyn it is because she thinks she doesn't like bastards. But I think the point about the Blackfyre Rebellion is this. If you create an alternate royal family, an alternate lineage, eventually those people are going to come into conflict, because who wouldn't want, they're both going to have a claim to power. And I also legally don't understand how this whole, well, in the event that Rob doesn't have a kid, John kids take over.
I don't think that would work, because he'd still have to legitimize him.
Exactly.
I don't think the document can conditionally legitimize him.
So. Exactly. This document that they have signed, if this document is related to John, then he has been legitimized from the moment they sign and witness it. And it's not, you can't make it conditional. It's not how it works.
Yeah, and it's for the future as well. Even if John would never claim against Rob's sons or whatever, you still have John's potential children. And, yeah.
I guess that, you know, from our perspective, we're reading all of the point of views of all the characters, and we understand that, you know, as much as you want to believe it or not, a rightful Targaryen is coming back to Westeros to claim the throne. Whether she wins it or not is obviously still up for debate. But from Kat's perspective there, the North is the North. You know, despite losing Winterfell, they still have a fairly strong hold with Rob and pre-Red Wedding, enough to believe that, well, Jon could come and, you know, if any ill comes to Rob, then he could usurp the throne and plant his kids on there in the future. From our perspective, we're seeing that there's a Targaryen coming back. So I guess the King in the North thing, so from my perspective anyway, is a bit of a, it's, oh yeah, it's great for now, but it's not going to last.
Exactly. I think Kat's point is valid.
I guess it'd be the Lord of Winterfell. It wouldn't have to be the King.
Yeah, of course.
It's who inherits,
but it's interesting in book... It's interesting in book five, like there is some credence to Catelyn's concerns because we have various players in the North trying to set up their own heir. So we have Littlefinger trying to set up Sansa. We have Manderly trying to set up Rickon. And then we have possibly this decree floating around for Jon. So it could come to a head for various factions of the North.
Isn't that just a gamble every like head house does? Like when they have multiple children, it's like one child could be a dick. Like one child could be Ramsay Bolton and kill the older brother, that the legitimate heir. Like it could just happen.
Happen frequently. But in history, right? I believe that at some point in this book we are going to get a northern civil war between Stark claimants, and that, you know, either real or fake, and I think that'd be awesome.
Did you think they'll have enough time for that before other shit goes down?
Yeah.
I mean, I think if there weren't the others and Dany and whatever, I think that would probably happen. But the North isn't going to be left to their own.
We're going to have a podcast on the 5-year gap, and this may be one storyline that suffers a little bit from that. But I could still see it happening.
That certainly would be very exciting, because it would lead credence to the others breaking south of the Neck. I mean, certainly if there was a Stark civil war, that would... Yeah. Definitely help them in their pursuit, you know, if they're going to go as far south as possible.
Yeah, and
I think the Starks would be so happy to find another Stark alive, they wouldn't go to war against them.
But what if it's not a real Stark?
Who's not a real Stark?
Like a fake Arya being...
What if it is a real Stark, and it's a Rickon versus Jon Snow? And it's a Rickon
riding in on a unicorn, all
thing.
Badass.
Yeah, like a feral Skagosi Rickon against a real Jon Snow, for sure. Or a Sansa.
I think this podcast has made it perfectly clear that it's actually very civilized on Skagos.
Oh yeah, it's beautiful there. I've had tea there the other week.
Yeah, right.
It's darling. They got great biscuits there.
Even to do Skagos butler voice.
Duncan, while you're here, you got to check out Skagos, mate. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Kieran and I are going on a Skagos.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah. What's up with Jane wanting to ride out and be with Rob? Is that just her? Because she doesn't want to get pregnant by him. So what's up?
The whole love, you know, husband wife thing. I find my wife likes to spend time with me too. It's annoying as shit.
It suggests that she might not have been privy to the, I don't know, to the plan to kill him. Because why would she want to be in the same room as him when the Red Wedding went down?
Right. And obviously, like, her fucking brother was expendable, the Knight of the Seashells, because he went.
Yeah. So my question is, did she know? Is it a double bluff? Like, I'm pretending to want to be with you, but I know you're going to send me back? Because they're obviously fucking a lot, but she's not getting pregnant.
I think this is still in the very, you know, playing the cards close to their chest. There's a few Freys that know about it. It's not quite widely known. I mean, I love the idea that it's pissing down with rain. Fuck it, let's just kill him anyway. But I mean, the previous chapters on previous rereads, there's just so much evidence. You know, the whole wars are won with ravens and quills, and not with, you know, stealing men. I'm butchering that paraphrasing, but I feel that it's already, his fate is sealed, and this is a final just doom fulfilled chapter, really.
Yeah, I just want to say this is one of my favorite chapters, I think, because like not a lot of plot happens necessarily. I mean, you get the reveal about Euron at the end or Baelon at the end, but the imagery is so haunting, like the rain just like crashing down on the hallway, the horses being sucked into the mud from their hooves, and just that whole scene at Old Stones. The first time I read it, I got like shivers down my spine, and it was one of the scenes that I really wanted to see on the show, and of course they didn't do it. But I just like imagine Catelyn wandering through the ruins and just her disintegrating psyche, and then turning a corner and seeing her teenage son just sitting there, and the fact that he's crownless and he's stroking Grey Wind, and it's just like you kind of remember, oh, he's just a kid. He's still just a kid, and he's just escaped this being a king for just a few minutes, and he's looking up at that statue.
Agree. I feel like this is going to be a huge chapter once we get the full Stoneheart storyline, that we're going to come back and see this.
It's so impressive that you remember your first time, because I'm pretty sure the first time I read this chapter, I was like, what the fuck just happened? Nothing thing happened? Like, what the fuck's going on? Like, why did they just spend all this time? And then on the reread, it's like, oh shit, like, this is so much like foreboding and like setting
it
like
is, it's like this environment. It's like this it's like this funeral procession. It's like they're transporting Rob and Catelyn to their final burial ground or something.
Yeah,
it's so dark and miserable. The scene in Oldstone, Catelyn starts to remember an encounter with Peter, where they're dressing up as Jenny of Oldstones and all that, and this scene seems really important. Like, there seems to be like a spiritual connections between Cat and Oldstones, and I think even the epilogue, that's where Merritt Frey gets lured to be hanged. So it seems like, I was wondering if like Stoneheart comes from Oldstones, like she's taken that name as this sort of final moment between her and Rob. Because this was sort of like this is sort of the final scene before the Red Wedding. It's the final moment between her and Rob, and it feels like a really powerful moment. Like, she wants to, in her warped Lady Stoneheart mind, is she wants to go back there and like change history or something. It's tied into this. And like looking up at the statue and hearing that story and realizing that this great king won all these battles and still his kingdom came to nothing, and this great castle is just kind of ruined and dismantled, and this statue is, the face has been weathered away by the winds, and you know, all of this glory that all of these characters are chasing kind of just, it ends in nothing. And exactly. Catelyn has this great line, like, we're all just songs in the end if we're lucky. Like that that seems like as close to a moral to the story to me as we can get.
Right,
Song of
Ice
and Fire, and that's all it is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Song of Ice and Fire, yeah.
You think, like, how many houses we've just seen, like, go extinct, like, from the Battle of the Blackwater, or, like, you know, the Dairies, who are huge Targaryen supporters, and then they're, like, big shit in the first couple of books, and then they're all dead. Like, Lancel takes over.
Yeah.
Like, and really the fact point. That we're just even talking about this, like, King Mud that, like, you know, reigned 1,000 years ago, that makes him immortal. Whereas, like, all these, like, lesser houses we've just seen go extinct, and, like, they're just remembered just due to recent memory, but not for anything, like, you know.
And you almost get the sense that that Drog realizes he's going to be the last Stark, because he says, you know, his heir failed him. He looks up at the statue and he's sort of realizing that he kind of failed all of his Stark ancestors.
Yeah, there's so much subconscious foreshadowing that he seems to internalize that and know that he's losing. Kat has this lovely line where she says, "My grief will consume me." And you think that's literally what's going to happen when she becomes Lady Stoneheart. Yeah, it's so tragic, this chapter. It's really moving. And it is tragic.
Sorry.
What was shocking to me, like, doing this linear reread, is I actually did go back, because we've got the timeline spreadsheet. And the original time they were there in the Whispering Wood was only on the 9th of January in the same year. Like, for some reason, I thought it was a long time ago. And it was only 11 months previously. And yet, look how many people have died for her. And it was that also made me realize that George moves slowly. Because the last time they were in the Whispering Woods was in a game.
Tell me about it.
It was in a Game of Thrones, and now we're in a Storm of Swords. So it kind of, like, implications for the 5-year gap. Like, that would have been in a very large amount of narrative time for him to leave alone. Because he really does go, as we know, day by day and crawl through. Sorry, Matt.
No, I was just kind of pissed when you said George moves slowly, and the news we just got off his blog.
That is very true.
Months away, yeah.
I had an interesting parallel reading this. I felt this chapter reminded me certainly of the troop movements and the difficulties they're having, of sort of Stannis in Dance, where he's struggling to get everyone through the snow, and he's losing horses and men, and it's that sort of ominous foreshadowing, although we're not there yet, so we don't know what the foreshadowing is. But it reminded me a lot of that. So I don't know if this maybe makes me rethink my Stannis outlook.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, that is interesting, because we already get, like, the pink letter saying that Stannis was defeated. But then we also got the Theon chapter, like, where it looks like, okay, so the Karstarks that are going to betray Stannis have been caught. Like, so I'm still up in the air. But yeah, it definitely, like, is not good.
And the good news is we'll find out in 2022.
Yeah.
If we're lucky.
That's very optimistic.
Inner Trump lets it be published.
Another little timeline point is that Baelon actually dies on the 15th of November, which is when the chapter begins. And so, because the journey takes 8 days, it doesn't take long for the news to get to Rob, which I thought was quite impressive. But it is 2 months after Stannis threw the leeches in the fire. So magics be slow in Westeros.
I think the toughest thing about the chapter is the final scene, where it's, you know, very dour for most of it, but then you get this realization that Baelon's dead.
You've got to figure
cut off, or was that it?
You've got to figure out that Stannis, I don't know, if Stannis threw the leeches on the fire and then 2 months later, Baelon is dead. Do you not think if you're Stannis, you start to worry about whether blood magic actually really works?
Yeah, I wouldn't take definitely. It seriously if, at that point if I was seeing it that way. Because it seems a bit like, oh, we'll just do this magic ritual now. And then whenever over the next 12 months anything happens, I'll just claim it as a result of this ritual.
Yeah. It's
kind of bullshit, though.
Yeah, it's total bullshit. And it's definitely an advantage of a linear reread when you realize, like, there are certain magics that definitely work in this. And we really get some with Thoros of Myr and...
Does this kind of shoot down the whole King's Blood? I've never really bought into the whole King's Blood thing where, you know, Stannis can chuck a leech into the flames and then that, you know, that your number's up, mate. That kind of thing. I'm much more of the impression that it's Melisandre birthing these two demons and the leeches have fuck all to do with it.
Yeah, I think it's more like just blood magic in general that they kind of like put an emphasis, like even like, what's her fucking name from the first book, the witch, like says like the blood magic is the strongest kind.
Oh, Mirimastur?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mirimath.
But I think that they kind of try to elevate King's Blood, like it's a, like, you look at these kings and they're just fucking regular people. Most of them are not nice people. Like,
no.
You know, it doesn't show that, like, their blood is any better than, you know, fucking, you know, Gendry's or who they use.
Do you think Melisandre thinks that the King's Blood is necessary and that it's doing something? Because, I mean, there's a difference between what's true and what she genuinely believes. And
I think that she thinks that Stannis is King Blood, because she also thinks that Stannis is, you know, Azor Ahai, that, you know, that blood is, you know, important, or I don't know.
You know what we should do, in the same way as some of the guys did a standalone Rob chapter, which I think Mary's editing and should come out soon. Maybe at the end of this book, someone should do if we get to the end of Dance, someone should do a standalone episode where we just talk about Melisandre, because she's another one of these really pivotal characters that we don't sort of,
I think that would be really interesting.
POV for, yeah, it'd be really cool.
I wanted to ask something when we were on the air discussion, but I forgot, and now it doesn't fit in anymore, but I want to ask anyway. Is it generally accepted that Jon is Ned's son in Westeros? Is this the general consensus?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
That was my
impression. Yeah, even in Winterfell, right? Because he says that it's Ashara Dane, they think.
Especially in Winterfell.
Yeah, you go away from my chapter, Tanya.
Duncan?
Tanya, patience.
I like
you met me.
Pops will reveal all.
I like how they pass through the Whispering Woods again, and you see all the decaying armor and all that, because the first time we pass through that, it's such a charged moment. You know, there's so much momentum behind them. They're heading down to attack the Lannisters, and then two books later, the tone is so different. And it really does feel like, and I think Catelyn a few times thinks about sort of this alternate history, like what if I'd married Brandon, and what if Theon had been killed by Jaime? So I just got a sense of like all these roads not taken as they were marching north again, and they can't really change history.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it's a great what if chapter.
It's also just another great chapter that shows the impotence of being a lady in Westeros, that she always thinks about decisions she can't make, influence she doesn't have anymore with Edmure and Rob, that she's alienated. And she just, you know, she looks at the Mormont women, Daisy, in her armour and thinks, gosh, maybe I would have been more useful if I had armour on. I think it's a great chapter on Kat feeling isolated and impotent.
Doesn't Cersei oftentimes think, like, if I was born with a dick, I'd be a ruler?
Yeah, and that's almost the defining characteristic of Cersei, is her absolute anger at not being born a man or having the opportunities that a man has. But with Kat, it manifests far more as sadness and almost melancholy than as anger.
Yeah.
So on that very melancholy note, we can move on to Bran 2, I think. And this, again, it's a big, big change. We're going to jump back a whopping 22 chapters, which is, in my edition, it's 275 pages, and it's in a different volume of Swords. But it also takes place on the same day, or the start of this, which is the 15th of November. And I think it's going to be Noah with the chapter summary.
Yes, ma'am. So Bran and co. continue their journey to the Wall, staying off of the King's Road. Despite staying off of the King's Road, Bran informs them that many a northerner, including Wall, Umber, Knots, and Liddell, dwell in the mountains. And spookily, Bran lets them know that they are also aware of them, despite no one having any sight of them. As night falls, Summer finds them a cave to stay in. However, there is a man fanning the flames of a fire as they approach. Bran judges him for a little due to the clasp on his cloak. They exchange pleasantries and he offers them food and an update on the geographical position. The man appears amicable to the Starks but informs them of squids and flayed men patrolling the King's Road asking after ghosts, which proves Jojen's paranoia to the King's Road to be accurate. He updates them of the Night's Watch's peril and the Lord Commander's folly north of the Wall. They spend the night in the cave, and when they awake, the Little is gone, leaving them some supplies for their journey. They set off north again, and along the way are potentially seen by a Warg Eagle, as well as finding out Hodor's real name, Walder. Bran comes to realise that Old Nan is likely not dead and is a prisoner in the Dreadfort and telling Ramsay bedtime stories as we discuss this chapter. The talk quickly turns to the stories, and Mira has one that Bran has never heard before, despite the protests of the Crannogmen. The story begins with a brave young man who lived in the Neck but did not have green dreams. He headed forth one day to visit the Isle of Faces and the Green Men. Frustratingly, Mira skips this crucial part of the series and tells him about a tourney instead. Upon his return home, he comes across this tourney, the Tourney of Harrenhal. Upon his arrival, the Crannogmen was set upon by three squire dickheads. However, they were beat off by a fearsome she-wolf. Following this, she invited him to join her and her brothers for the feasting and merriment. He met the wild wolf, Brandon, the shy wolf, Ned, and the wolf pup, Benjen. Despite her best efforts, the Crannogmen did not want revenge upon his assailants. As the tourney progressed, it was 5 days long, and upon the second morning, a mystery knight appeared and challenged the knights of the dishonourable squires in the lists. Unsurprisingly, he felled his foes, but upon them requesting ransom of their armour, he only requested they teach their squires honour. What a gent. The Mad King, being a twat, sends men after him the following day, the men being the men after the Mystery Knight, that is, but is unsuccessful. Bran hypothesizes that the Mystery Knight is a Crannogman. However, Mira doesn't spoil anything. He goes on to criticize the story and painfully fantasize about being a knight one day. And that's the chapter.
I was actually kind of hoping that you'd read, like, I could go for, like, the direct reading of the book of that story.
I find Noah's version so much good. More poetic.
Would you like a reread, Varley?
No, I mean, we're running long.
Okay, no, it's fine, man. It's not like I have my book here or anything.
Do you want to do a reread?
I think that was a yes.
Go on. Do a reread, Noah. Do it. Make us happy. Go on.
Do it.
I was thinking of doing that, but it's quite a long couple of pages.
But it's so good.
It really is, but there's a lot of Bran interrupting, saying, "Oh, it's definitely the Crannogmen."
Oh yeah, it's Bran.
Yeah, people interrupting when other people are doing recaps of stories is like really, really annoying.
We frown upon that.
We never do that shit.
In America, we do it all the time, and I will continue to do it. Thank you very much.
Indeed. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to leave it for now, but just saying, if Valkyrist wants a squeaky voice Bran or an annoying interrupter Jojen, you know where to come for that reread.
Yeah, man.
Oh, mate. All right. I'm the man.
You'll have to audition like everyone else.
Ooh, harsh.
Yes, so I wanted to start this with, who is Hodor?
No show spoilers, please. I know there's something in the show, but I don't know what, but no show spoilers.
Bite your tongue, Joe.
I'll try.
Who do you think he is?
Hodor is. He's like God announcing himself to Moses. He's just like Hodor.
He's like Tom Bombadil.
Yeah. He is eldest. And
outside of time, outside of corruption, outside of good or evil.
And we've never seen Tom Bombadil and Hodor in the same room together. So the same person.
Boom.
Nailed it. Confirmed. Next topic.
It is known.
Love it.
All right, so let's lay this out on the table. Hodor is, let's guesstimate, what, 40 years old in the books?
Okay.
Yeah, sound about right?
No,
I thought he was younger
in the books.
Okay, possibly. I'm throwing it out there.
That's just because you're so young, you think everyone else is really old.
Yes, I am a baby.
But he's like the stable boy in the books, isn't he? He's quite young,
but that doesn't necessarily... I mean, it's not like he has... many career options.
So yeah.
Stay stable boy forever anyway. So I don't think that tells us anything about his age.
Well, he was big enough to be a knight, Bran says in one chapter. Like, if he didn't just have a simple mind, like, he would have been a great warrior.
I don't know what that means, though, because Sir Shadrick is a knight, and he's allegedly shorter than me.
Yeah, but he's a mad knight, so, you know. Hodor's a gentle giant, and, you know, Shadrick's the mad mouse.
And also, you got to remember, Bran is, what, a boy of, at this stage, 10 years old? Something like that? So I think anyone's going to look pretty huge, especially surrounded by Crannogmen.
And Bran's as big as he's going to get. I mean, he should just start smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. Because...
Why not? But so my point was, is if he's around, let's say, 35, 40 years old, could he potentially be one of Walder's sons or grandsons, or is he a completely separate Walder?
Oh, I don't think it matters, does it? I mean, like, what benefit would
it? Of course it doesn't matter.
I don't think he's a Frey, if that's what you're asking.
Well.
Why do you think he's a Frey?
Is it just the name?
Well, it's just the name, purely. I mean, I'm being devil's advocate here, trying to play on everyone's, oh, no, you know, Hodor's great, but then he turns out to be Hodor Frey.
No. Well, I mean, one of the phrases is named Aegon. So, like, there's names, like, just flying around Westeros. Like, you know, okay, it might be
Aegon the Conqueror was a Frey, confirmed.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
Isn't the theory that Duncan the Tall is sort of one of Hodor's ancestors?
Dyer. Exactly. That's the interesting
isn't one,
part.
That's, isn't that's one of the forthcoming...
I think that's one of Brienne's ancestors, mate.
Yeah, the Duncan Egg, one of the new Duncan Egg novels, if they're ever written, is going to be set in Winterfell.
Who knows? Well, Hodor could be,
right?
Brienne's dad.
Yeah, the She-Wolves of Winterfell.
Hodor isn't Brienne's dad, mate.
Why not?
If only
that
we
wouldn't work out age-wise, would it? He'd have to be much older.
Out facts.
Brienne knows her father.
Well, allegedly. We've never seen them in the same room.
I mean...
What?
Hodor is Lord Selwyn. Okay.
I'm dragging this conversation back to discussing the events in the chapter.
Okay, all right. I had a beautiful quote that I pulled out.
Go on, then.
Which Jojen says, "If ice can burn, then love and hate can mate. Mountain or marsh, it makes no matter. The land is one."
I know, that's lovely.
I thought that was really nice.
He's a Zen master, isn't he?
Oh my God, he is Bruce Lee.
What I quite liked about doing this in a sort of linear order is at the end of the last chapter, snuck in behind that big Balon plot point, you have the fact that the Crannogmen are suddenly really important because Rob needs them to help him out with his battle plans, but also because that's where, if you believe in this inheritance becoming a major thing, that's where the news of it is going. And then straight away you're in with Jojen and Mira and you're learning more about them because they're sort of, I don't know, they're often very mysterious and they hold the key to so many epic mysteries. So I like the fact that it's contrasted from how
the
men back to the kids. Oh, that's kind of neat.
They escalate the Crannogmen importance, and I feel after this, the Howland Reed question of when the fuck are you going to turn up kind of starts burning in the back of your mind a little bit brighter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or has he already turned up, Noah?
Hidden as somebody else.
Oh! Howland Reed is the Sparrow.
Howland Reed is Hodor?
I'll let you elaborate, Joe.
No, it's just Howland Reed is the High Sparrow is one of my favourite bits of tinfoil.
Do you want to just give a quick summary for people who haven't heard of it before and then why you think it's tinfoil?
Well, it's been picked up because Howland Reed hasn't appeared and is known to be sort of short stature, and then suddenly someone of short stature appears in King's Landing and is causing a stir, so to speak.
That can't
I just don't
be
think
more
it would fit with a narrative. Like,
why
would a Crannogman go and try and become, you know, some sort of, you know, Faith of the Seven preacher? I don't think it makes any sense. But
I think
like
Howland would be more interested in defending the Neck, and aren't they like sort of harassing the Ironborn, spitting poison darts at them? They call them the Bog Devils in the Iron Islands. Yeah. I think he's there.
Yeah, well, they're also the mud eaters or frog eaters or whatever to the phrase, right?
Mm. Everyone
or,
has like just
a unique name for them.
Or he could be Sir Shadrick, who knows? And he could be whisking Sansa off to safety.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
That's one of the things from the preview chapters that I picked up on. I was like, wait a minute. This guy's next to Sansa now? This isn't good.
Hmm. Anywho, I think that all of those Howland Reed theories just come out of our desperation, A, to see him, and B, to see, or for him to unlock mysteries that we
Well, because he has all the answers
exactly.
to various theories.
And to a certain extent, there's something to be said for, can George ever really bring him back in the way that can we just get Treebrand, because suddenly they know everything in a POV We certainly can't get a POV because he'd be privy to...
Oh, no.
We thought that about Melisandre before she got hers, and then she just didn't know anything.
She's just confirming the fact that, like, she believes a lot of stuff that may or may not be true. And
yeah, she's a lot more credulous than we thought she was, put it that way.
Adding more mystery than clarity to the situation.
Yeah, but there's lots of other lovely stuff in this chapter. Sorry, Matt, you go.
No, so just for like Pop's quote that you just brought up, like it reminds me, I just read American Gods, and I know it's a whole big thing now because it's on TV, but isn't that like almost the same kind of thing as American Gods, where it's like the Earth is just vying for itself and really doesn't care about like what these like little gods are doing? Like, anyone read that book?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, I'm sure some of our readers, listeners even. So if our listeners do get your, like, have reflections on that, you can get in touch with us, I guess.
Yeah, I've read it, but I don't have anything clever to say to this. I'm not sure about that comparison. Yeah.
There are some nice bits of foreshadowing here. I mean, I think of the many cool things that happen in the tale that Mira tells, you do have the phrase betraying someone, which is a nice bit of foreshadowing.
Who did the phrase betray?
Well, one of the guys who attacks the mystery knight is a Frey. So you get the idea that the Freys are not to be trusted. It's just laid on thick and fast in every chapter before the Red Wedding.
Oh, I think we got that like book one.
I know, but it gets laid on, right? Every single chapter. I also
Brand gets a lot of it with Big Walder and Little Walder.
I love the fact that old Nan just has a theory for everything that's to do with deep past mysteries and genetics, right? So she thinks that Bran likes climbing because he's probably a descendant of the mountain-dwelling Flints. I thought that was quite funny. But you know when Jojen dreams the wolves will come again? Is that like a proper prophecy?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe.
But there is no Westeros now. Not Westeros. There is no Winterfell now. So it's just metaphorical.
The wolves are scattered, but they'll return. Did any of you guys understand this story the first time you read it? With all the monomakers and everything?
Of all the stuff I didn't understand the first time I read this, this actually I did get. That's like the one thing probably in five books.
I'm with Bina. I got this, and I looked up the Porcupine Knight and the Pitchfork Knight, and they're all they're bannermen of the Freys. So I quite enjoyed that sort of piling on the I don't even know how to put it, the cuntishness of the phrase, and we all continue to hate them.
Such a poetic.
Well put. I think I just read it too fast and I didn't pick up. It felt significant, but I figured I'll go back to it and try and suss it out. Like, I sort of got the Starks, but all the other, there's so many characters, I couldn't weave them all together, their relationships.
Yeah,
but it was just a good story. Like, you didn't have to. I mean, because Bran doesn't get it either. He can just enjoy it as a fable.
No, I mean, Bran's quite an idiot in this whole storytelling, isn't he?
Yes, it was frustrating.
But he's also like 6 or something.
I think he's 9 or 10. Not to not that that should make any difference to how he interprets the story, but some of the questions he asks, you can clearly tell George is having a great time writing this because you're sitting there fuming, throwing your book across the room, and Bran's like, "Oh, but it was definitely the Crannogman, wasn't it?" And you're just there like, "Fuck you bastard! Just ask the right questions."
Jojen is literally telling you that it's like your father and your family. Are you sure you never heard this story?
I know, right? It's like, no, I've told you 5 times. I haven't heard this. Tell me all the fucking details.
It's sort of like a tutoring lesson from the Reeds. Like, they're telling him this story in order to gauge his like critical thinking. Like, you're not asking the right questions.
Brain training.
Yeah.
It's going to be great when he has like godlike powers, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can just flip it's to the back of the idiot. Textbook.
I am Bran of Ice.
But this story is sort of one of the key pieces of clues for R+L=J, isn't it? That they were actually genuinely in love, Rhaegar and Lyanna.
Well, it's interesting you bring me onto that topic, Duncan. I feel that is one of the more interesting pieces of evidence for A+D=, A plus
N. Don't even fucking say it.
Come on, mate. You know Ashara got a bit of that Ned. You know she did.
Hmm.
Come on, guys.
Do you guys have anything else on the Bran chapter, or should we move on to Arya 5? Okie dokie, I take that that we're moving on. Okay, so after Bran 2, we go to another Stark sibling. This is a much smaller interval. We jump forward 5 chapters or 60 pages and 2 days. And I believe it is Barley doing the summary.
It's me.
Are you going to do your summary in a Dick Van Dyke Cockney accent?
You have to, or you get kicked out.
You don't have to.
You really don't have to. But it'd be funny if you did a bit of it in a Van Dyke Cockney accent.
Oh, yeah? We find the no, I can't even. I lost it. They lasted like
Cockney,
this,
not
like,
Scandinavian.
You tried.
Yeah. Okay, so we get to the Stony Step, and it's Arya, and we learn about the Battle of the Bells, which is actually like pretty badass. Like Lord Cunnington is a fucking good warrior. He was able to like beat through and injure Hoster Tully pretty severely, which is great. We also learned that Robert was healing from a wound by fucking whores. And that he eventually killed Miles Mouton, who is a famous knight that, even though I looked him up on Tower of the Hand, was mentioned in two books in one sentence each, that he was a squire to Rhaegar and he was a famous knight. So that's how famous he was. Robert killed a bunch of people, but Connington, yeah, he killed the Tullys and Dennis Aaron, who was kind of outlined in a later chapter as he would have been the heir to the Aerie, but is not. So we find out that, like, the town's really shy. It's kind of hiding from everyone. Like, everyone's plundered this town. Like, the wolves, the Lannisters, the Bloody Mummers, probably on both sides. Like, who knows? We find out that the Karstark men are still searching for the Kingslayer throughout the thing, and that caging people in crow cages, it leads to a horrible death, and that if you're found raping someone, you get your dick cut off. That sounds pretty brutal. They have this character that they call the Huntsman, and then the tavern keeper calls him the Mad Huntsman, and he's just basically fucking up anyone who fucks up his people. So, I mean, for some reason, like, the Brotherhood Without Banners are like, well, you should just hang them. And he's like, no, they fucking are monsters. So we put them in these cages to die slowly. And they're like, well, we'll shoot them with arrows. Arya uses Cereal Pharrell method to realize that the bar that she's drinking at is actually a brothel. Gendry almost bangs his half-sister, stepsister. I don't know what it would be, but
it's just not good either way.
Yeah. Also, I'm guessing that Hoster Tully banged the barmaid because her name is Tansy, and that's what he's saying as he dies. Arya thinks that she's had too many baths within the past 2 weeks because she's like, I bathed twice at Acorn Hill, and that was a fortnight ago. I don't need another bath. And that's just how disgusting, like, this whole world should be. Where, like, they have, like, people hanging in crow cages, slowly dying. They have, like, people that don't want to take a shower every, like, 2 weeks. She says her little prayer, and they're like, well, we brought in a Lannister, and it's not the Lannister you think. It's one of the people on her list, so maybe she'll meet up and be able to, you know, kill him. Anyway. Oh, that and the peach. I don't know if this means anything regarding Renly, but the peach is a brothel. And the peach is also what he offers Stannis that Stannis vehemently denies. That's it.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Okie dokie. Comments on the chapter? From my perspective, looking again at the time stamps and stuff being all linear-y, I just think it was kind of cool that in the previous chapter we got the memory of potentially when Rhaegar met Lyanna at the tourney. Then here we're getting the memory and seeing the repercussions with Robert's rebellion. So that kind of made me happy. And I also thought it was nice that we had two sort of minor characters telling Stark children of the history of their own family that they didn't know. So I think it's kind of, you know, it's quite nice. It just makes me wonder, like, are they sort of unusually ignorant of their own family history? Is this normal for all kids? You figure that stuff out when you get older.
Yeah.
Sorry, Duncan.
I've learned a lot about my family history over the last, like, 2 years. So
maybe it's true.
But you'd think in those kinds of settings with the noble families and stuff, they should know a bit more. But I guess we don't really know how much other kids know about their families,
yeah,
do we?
We don't really have the context, do we? Sorry, Duncan, I interrupted you as you were about to say something.
Just a comment. Just the description of the men in the crow cages might be up there for, like, one of the most gruesome paragraphs in the book, where they're describing, like, the burnt flesh and the flies crawling over their skin and the skin sloughing off bone. It's a very, very vivid writing.
They're still, like, alive, really, aren't they? That's the worst part.
And, yeah, the dryness of their,
it's horrible.
It's also a good insight into just, I guess, what Septon Maribald talks about, like, the broken man, the idea that once you're at war long enough, you just kind of you forget who you are and you just start living like an animal. And you see even the Stark forces, we think of as good guys, but even they're committing horrible acts as the war just turns sour, I guess.
Well, in this chapter, I think it's called the Townsman. I don't think he's actually given a name. He's like, well, they came looking for the Kingslayer, but then when they couldn't find him, they're like, they decide to look for gold and rape women. Like, you know, like you do, I guess. Like,
yeah.
It's just like, oh my God, like, what animals?
It's, yeah, they've lost faith in their cause, I guess. And it sort of shows the repercussions of Catelyn's act. Even though it was done for noble intentions, it's caused a lot of, you know, death and suffering, much like taking Tyrion did for the Riverlands.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But my cat hate is growing right now. No, but they even say, like, the Mad Huntsman, they raped his wife and I think his sister and his daughter. And
they...
Yeah, like burnt down like Stony Steps, like front doors and shit like that too. But it's just like, oh my God, like no wonder he's like hanging people in cages just to watch them die. Like,
it's so horrible. All the things you see in Harrenhal and this chapter here, it's so vicious and like it's really uncomfortable to read. Mostly it's Arya's chapters. Like a lot of what we read is in courts and at war tables, but Arya really sees the worst parts of this war. And just
right, and then you wonder why she's like a broken psychopath, you know, like why she wants to like just murder everyone. It's like, oh, that's it's all this, she knows is horrible.
It is. It's this conditioning of violence, just seeing it every day, in and out, inhaling, exhaling it, being taught that you have to use it in order to survive or you will be the victim of it. It's horrible. You can see why Arya becomes what she becomes in these chapters.
Totally agree. Bina?
I love that we're having this discussion with the birds chirping in the background.
Very serene. Appropriate. Yes.
Yeah, so... Just so to keep everyone with the too much information, I have a suspicion that the dog needs to poop, so I'm outside in my portico right now. And it's very pleasant.
Very nice.
That makes the bird sounds less, I don't know. That changes everything.
Well, if you hear two big drops, that's the dog pooping.
I have to say, though, I didn't have lots of really like serious comments on this. It just felt like this was far more plot. Like nothing happened in the cat chapter, but it provoked more questions or... contemplation for me in this chapter.
I like how Robert literally has bastards just everywhere. Like, he can't swing a cat and not hit a
bastard in every port. Must have fucked a lot of women.
I feel like Arya maybe gets a little bit, the way that you can kind of feel her turning against the North in this chapter with her, you know, they're saying, oh, they were wolves who came here to do this and that, and actually, what we've just discussed now is that they were almost rebels and traitors. They were following Rickard Karstark's orders to go out and find the Kingslayer. And then with him executed, they had no one to kind of go back to. So they were just ultimately left as brigands. And I feel like this is her almost first interaction with Northmen since Harrenhal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and she has this really like weird spot where she's like, these are Northmen. These were John's men. Or not John, Rob's men.
Yeah.
And it, like, you know, there's like some cognitive dissonance or something. Like she's like, okay, well, I should give them water, but should I? Because yeah, it's really interesting. I don't think that she knows that the Karstarks betrayed.
No, she doesn't.
Right.
But that's what I mean, is in this is before, you know, the Boltons of and everything and the Red Wedding and all sorts, and you're seeing even now that her perception towards Northmen are changing, and all she's really got is Harwin, who's kind of reminding her of the good times almost.
Yeah, but even he is a like shows that like he's not loyal to the Starks anymore. He's loyal to Beric and like, you know, the Brotherhood, like and you get it through her point of views and, you know, the other books, that it's like, you know, when a Northman is worth like 10 Lannister men and then they all get slaughtered and she's like, but I thought, like, you know, the Northmen would keep us safe because like they're so good. And like, yeah, I think she goes through a lot of kind of corrections.
She's learning a lot about just the habits of men and how they are and how, you know, North or South, you know, I'm sure Lannister men say the same about Northmen.
Right.
I think there's an interesting parallel here to Sansa, because she's so wrapped up in all her fairy tale stories with the handsome prince who's a lovely person and whatever, and then she finds out that this isn't as close to the truth as she'd like. And Arya does have those ideas as well, that Northmen are just more honorable and just better people than everyone else. And then she right. gets to know that not everything she believes is true either.
And really, everyone's a monster.
Yeah.
Well, I think all the Stark children have this idyllic view of the world. And you sort of see that with Rob, I guess. He just can't fathom. He's won every battle, but he can't fathom why he's losing the war and that whole interaction with the statue. And Arya as well, you know, she idealizes the Northmen. She's told, you know, they're worth 50 of any southern knight. But she's learning, too, that it's not as simple as good versus evil. There's different factors at play. And, yeah, war changes people. And I guess Bran's kind of at the other end of that. He's being taught some history, but he still wants to twist it into a hopeful, happy, you know, fairy tale. But the rest of them are learning, I guess, the reality of the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're both kind of learning lessons about the people they've grown up with these very protected views that Ned has given them. And they're both almost shattering them and discovering what the real world is beyond that. I wanted to mention, actually, so I think I've said this on a previous podcast, but so I'm of the opinion that Richard Lonmouth, one of Rhaegar's squires,
is Lem.
Miles Mootin is Lem Lemoncloak.
Why?
So because he's a knight of Skulls and Kisses, and the girl on the little dwarf on the hill says,
yes, the Lady of High Heart, whatever she's called.
And we've never seen them in the same room together.
Oh, well, exactly. That's true. Well, that's because Miles Mootin is famous but dead. So I know I've said this on other podcasts, but how, like, what the fuck is going on in Westeros? That, like, there's a famous knight. What wars were there that he became famous in? No one knows. Like, the Mormonts are like, oh, we have to defend ourselves from the Iron Islands. It's like, why the fuck is one part of your country attacking another part and nothing is being done about it?
Because, like, basically, Robert sort of wasn't really interesting in ruling. He went to war to avenge a kidnapped girl who wasn't into him anyway. He's become a ruler. He doesn't give a shit about it. He spends the whole time on the booze. His country is run by corrupt people who are skimming off the realm. And he has federalized power. He's devolved it to the individual rulers of his kingdoms. So it's up to Ned to prosecute, right? It's Ned will keep peace within the North. But if the Iron Island Islanders start raiding someone who's part of another kingdom, that'll go on because there's effectively no strong unified federal power. And that's why shit's going to break down.
I would think the only thing that Robert is interested in besides fucking and drinking is fighting. So, like, any, like, little thing, he you know, like, we hear about, like...
I don't think Robert's been interested really in fighting ever since he got the throne, and he's not in the physical condition to do it anyways. But to me, the problem with Westeros is it's not really a united kingdom. Westeros is basically a devolved power structure. There's no real thing as Westeros. There's no real unified centralized power. And so naturally, when anyone makes any kind of play for disorder, it's going to fragment very quickly. It's a damning indictment of the way the realm was organized under Robert.
There just isn't, like, the technology to organize around with that size centrally, though. It's Westeros is like the size of a continent with... with ravens,
it's too big.
Like, it's they couldn't have centralized power, I don't think. It's why the Targs appointed wardens and kept families in place.
But the point is, no, I profoundly disagree. Geography, technology can make it far harder to do that. But a wise ruler tries to find mitigants, and you've exactly identified how the Targaryens tried to do it. And maybe dragons were like a unifying technology that everyone was afraid of. But it's not like Robert sitting in the small council thinking, fuck me, it's really hard to keep this country together. How can I do this shit? I tried to do that and it didn't work. He's never even bothered trying. It's a massive dereliction of duty.
So are you talking about the Iron Man attacking their island? Because that's more of a historical thing.
No, but just in general, that, like, basically Varley's question was, what the fuck's going on in Westeros? My point is, right. It's Westeros, like, as we knew it when we met it, because we've known Westeros basically Civil War and pre-Civil War. The only Westeros we have known is Robert, and that is not an effectively unified country. So of course anything can go on.
But if you're talking about... If you're talking about Robert, it's mostly been peaceful, hasn't it? Like, when the Greyjoys did, and they were crushed. Other examples of...
Darcy Mormont saying, like, the Iron Islanders, we've had to defend ourselves. It's like, well, yeah, okay, so I've had to defend myself from, you know, no one. Like, Like, who has America had to defend themselves by? Like,
no, but the Mormonts, Darcy Mormont is saying she's had to defend herself. She has needed to learn in her lifetime. So surely that means in Robert's rebellion, right? How old is Daisy?
Right.
Daisy ain't learning weaponry for no reason.
Yeah, in Daisy's case, it might be wildlings, and it also might just be like rogue ironborn ships, like pirates, essentially. Maybe not an actual concentrated or directed attack from the Iron Islands. Like, I haven't heard any examples of them attacking in force since the rebellion, until now, obviously.
Yeah, but nonetheless, if you've got rogue ships or whatever, I mean, that's not getting prosecuted. It shouldn't be up to Daisy to get armed up to defend against that ship. Robert should be sending emissaries to his warden, who runs the Iron Islands, saying, "Dude, you have to keep the shit in check." Or to Ned, who is controlling the Iron Islands by proxy, and say, "You need to keep these rogues in check."
What are they named from Seaguard? Like, in Theon's POV, like, he talks about like drinking with one of the heirs of Seaguard. Yeah, and his father's like, "Malisters and Ironborn are enemies," and like, they even brought it up. They're like, "Yeah, well, we're whoring. Like, yeah, we have a bell that rings when you guys come around, and it hasn't rung in like 100 years. So, yeah, I guess we're enemies, but like, you know, we're drinking and whoring together."
Yeah, I mean, Robert's dismissal of the growing wildling threat is pretty clear indictment of how seriously he takes the borders of the realm.
For me, it's even a stopwatch.
Ned tells him that a king is mustering his forces north of the wall, and Robert just shrugs it off. So he definitely has lapsed, yeah.
I think Robert is lucky rather than clever. You know, a stopwatch tells the right time twice a day. And just because there was peace broadly during the years of Robert's rule does not mean that Robert created the sort of the structure for peace.
He doesn't get the credit
for that in my eyes at all.
Well, no, I mean, he created strong alliances and he had good wardens installed in the various parts of his kingdom. Mm. I mean, that's
did
the
he,
reason it was
let, good. Let's go through the wardens.
Ned held the north.
Let's go through the wardens of his kingdom and figure out which ones are ultimately put the interests of the kingdom first and are loyal to him, and which ones turn on a dime.
So Ned in the north.
He had wardens who were basically biding their time.
Tywin.
Tywin's not a good time. Yeah, exactly.
Mace Tyrell.
No.
And Jaime's appointed.
John Arryn, who was Hand of the King and Warden of the East.
Yeah.
Or Warden of the Vale.
Yeah, John Arryn.
So John Arryn and Ned are the only decent ones in there.
Well, Doran.
No, Doran is definitely biding his time. Viz Quinter.
Well, he's not a warden, he's just Prince of Dorne.
Yeah, but still, ruler of a constituent kingdom.
But Dorne didn't rise up. So he's a good warden of the South.
But it might, you see, Robert's rule is cut short, so we don't know what people are planning. And then everything gets thrown up in the air. I mean, in a sense, this is counterfactual history, so it's not, you know, hugely helpful. I don't want to derail the podcast into sort of an anti-Robert rant.
Robert's definitely a terrible king, don't get me wrong. But it was the cutting short that threw everything into chaos.
He also admits that he's a horrible king. He's like, I wish I was like winning the crown more than wearing it. Like, that was like
Tywin got so lucky. Like, the fact that he attacked a king's army while the king was alive. What would Robert have done if he went back and found that out?
Oh my god,
it's insane. The Lannisters were so freaking lucky.
The way that they act, it's like, yeah, you're exactly right. It's fucking absurd. It's like,
I wish Ned had sent Loras to lead that army. That would have just wrecked Lannisters if they had killed Loras Tyrell.
I'm with you, Duncan. That 100%. Would have been amazing.
Should have listened to Sansa.
Mm. Yeah. Everyone should just listen to Sansa.
One of the few times I will agree.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Anything else more specifically on Arya 5, Abe, before we move on to Arya 6?
Oh, we went way off book there.
Yeah, exactly. And I hold up my hand as being partly to blame for that.
I know, goddamn it, being a Jesus.
Oh, sorry, I was just saying that they mentioned Connington a few times in this book, and Euron obviously in the Rob chapter, so setting up major characters towards the later parts of the series.
Yep.
I agree, and on the Connington subject, how crushing would you say this defeat is? Because I feel that Connington got very unlucky in this chapter. Well, not in this chapter, but in Robert's Rebellion.
Well, he says so in Dance of Dragons. He's like, you know, like, it burnt him. It, like, showed that he was ineffectual. That led to his exile. And he, like, mentions it to someone else. And is like, you're like, I did as much as Tywin Lannister could have done. And the guy's like, nope, Tywin Lannister would have burned the fucker to the ground.
It's,
pulled out Robert's burnt corpse. And, you know.
It's true. He makes it sound a lot more crushing and defeatist. But I think a lot of it I almost feel that if the Mad King had kept faith with Connington, they could have, because he was quite, you know, he killed a lot of guys in single combat. He was a very competent swordsman. He did genuinely try everything he could have.
Chapter shows he's like, he was a badass warrior, like as badass as like maybe Robert. Like he cut through people that of like renown.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this on the Him to Spring podcast, but even killing Robert wouldn't necessarily have ended the rebellion because you
absolutely
had Starks, Tyrells, not Tyrells, Starks, Tullys, Arryns all converging on that one spot. So they still might have beaten the army and then started their march to King's
Indeed.
Landing. I don't know who they would have installed as king, but, you know, it wasn't a sure bet. But it's interesting, the fact that haunts him, that decision not to burn down the city haunts him, doesn't bode well for the Stormlands. That was also brought up on the podcast.
Yeah, agree.
I think because it was a Stark, you know, Lyanna Stark, who effectively started this war, would not, you know, Robert's death would not have nullified the rebellion. It would have almost exacerbated it in a way. Who knows what would have happened after, because it was quite a pinnacle defeat at the Stony Sept.
Yeah, it contributed to Robert's legend, but I guess it was only called Robert's Rebellion after the fact, once he was crowned. I mean, he seemed to be the main forerunner for being king, but who knows?
Okay, I'm ready to move on to Arya 6, everyone.
Sure. Oh, actually, I mean, they might have even been able to make peace with Rhaegar if Robert had been killed, because he was the main force behind slaying Rhaegar. So, I don't know. Anyway, counterfactual.
True. I think Rhaegar... Do you think Rhaegar was more open to peace and say if this battle had won, then it would have been? Because in the quote you were talking about, Varley, where Blackheart says if he'd have done as much as Tywin Lannister, he would have killed Robert, and then Tully and Stark would have turned their tails and run. I don't know if that would have been enough.
I don't think Rhaegar
would have accepted that.
I don't think that, I mean, we don't get it much from Ned. I don't think, you know, like he was just doing his duty, but the fucking Mad King, I'd already killed his father, his brother. You know, Rhaegar kidnapped his sister. So, like, I don't think the Starks and the Targaryens were going to be friends anytime soon.
Well, the Mad King would have to go. I mean, if they could get Rhaegar to a table, maybe they could say, all right, this guy is nuts. He has to go. But if you're king, we can have peace. But, I mean, also, does Ned actually think he kidnapped Lyanna? That's more Robert's cross.
Right. But, I mean, doesn't Rhaegar even say as much to Jaime or something? Like, you know, there will be changes.
Yeah.
We'll have a great council once I get home from the Trident, which is like,
I
feel like I could take on the whole empire myself. Like, oh boy, like, you know, you're going to die. Like, look at the picture of my new baby and wife. It's
great. 3 days till retirement. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Rhaegar's quotes were before the Trident, though. Whereas this battle was quite early on. Ned hadn't.
Well, they had to be before the Trident because he died at the Trident.
Well, true, but I mean, Ned hadn't been made aware of what had happened at the Tower of Joy, and God knows what he was feeling at this time. You know, if he was still believing the same as what Robert was, which was public knowledge, as far as anyone knew, he was probably just as inflamed. And I doubt that making peace or whatever that Blackheart suggested to Connington would have been enough to make Ned just turn his tail and go back north.
Mm.
Bina, grab control of this podcast, or else we're going to talk about this forever.
Yeah, I agree. This sounds like a really fascinating topic. I suspect this is a standalone podcast episode, actually, sort of like a counterfactual history one. I suggest we get back onto Arya 6, unless anyone's got any specific Arya 5 stuff.
No, I'm with you.
Okie dokie. So on to Arya 5. Arya 6. So the reason we were actually planning on just doing 3 chapters, as has become typical, but Arya 6 basically just continues on for Arya 5, so it just made sense to roll on. So here we jump forward another 5 chapters, or 55 pages in my edition. The events just are consecutive. And I, for once, am summarising a chapter, which is my own fault, because I added it last minute, so I can pass it off to anyone else. So in Arya 6, we find Arya and Gendry in a sinister secret cave controlled by the Brotherhood Without Banners. Arya is unimpressed by the needy, scrawny Thoros of Myr. She sort of thinks, is this really who this guy is? Not amazing. Sandor just mocks the lot of them, as is his wont, and is having none of them trying to foist the mountain's crimes onto him. He actually just comes across as really pissed off, but actually pretty rational. Like, what, just because a Lannister man once did this to you, does that mean I get to be hanged for it? It's just nonsense. Arya then does throw out a genuine, legitimate accusation at the Hound, which is that he killed Micah, the butcher's boy, back in Game of Thrones. But Sansa rightly points out that he was following the prince's orders, and even Arya's own sister said that Micah struck Joffrey first. So from his perspective, you know, fair play. Beric Dondarrion then wanders in and arbitrarily sentences Sansa to trial by combat. It's just such a completely fixed match because he's not going to give Sansa armor. And he's obviously a little bit sort of frightened of a Hound because he sort of, you know, he makes sure there's archers trained on him, really looses him from his chains. Arya notices that Beric has got scars that show he's run straight through with a lance and has obviously survived, and that the Hound must be frightened because obviously the rumors are that you can't kill Beric. Nonetheless, the Hound carries on talking a good game, and this is effectively just an entire chapter of him sort of trash-talking people who are talking nonsense, which is something I highly approve of. Beric and his stooges pray to the Lord of Light. The Hound says, I mean, there's so many great lines in this chapter, but one of them is, he says, this cave is dark too, but I'm the only terror here, which is really brilliant. But then, you know, Thoros does his usual cheap fire trick, and that naturally freaks the Hound out. And in the course of the fight, the back of his legs catch fire. He parries a blow, his shield gets on fire, and he tries to sort of crack it and break it to sort of get rid of fire. It's all pretty petrifying. And he's in an incredibly weakened position. He's obviously very frightened. And Arya's willing Beric at this point to kill him, and everyone's willing Beric to win. And so the Hound manages to get a massive blow in first, and he cuts through Beric's flaming sword, which is awesome, and then just slices him from the neck right down through the chest, which one would have thought would kill a man. So Arya's obviously very upset that the gods haven't ruled fairly and that Sansa's been allowed to win. And she's also kind of a little bit shocked to see just how discombobulated he is with all the burns, and he's crying for help. She literally watches strips of burnt flesh fall off of him, which is absolutely disgusting. But she still keeps, like, sort of taunting him, admit it that you killed someone. And then Sansa, sort of true to form, even though he's suffering and all this pain, taunts her and says, yes, you know, I did kill him and I loved it. And I saw your sister being beaten and I saw your father being executed. So it's just this amazing, intense relationship where they both, I think, actually have, well, I think he has some potentially residual fondness for her, but it's just this absolute, sort of incredibly emotionally intense relationship. Where they keep going at each other and going at each other. She then damns him to hell, but then we get this sort of creepy sort of stealth sneaking up Beric, who's been newly resurrected, and said he says he's already there, and that's sort of drop mic end of the chapter. So that's basically the end of the chapter, but it's just a joy. My particular favourite line, I shit better men than you, which I think needs to be worked into everyday situations as often as possible, really.
Fantastic.
I know we've said this already, but Arya's arc is just horrific. Like, the stuff this child is seeing, and that she's sort of this bloodlust that wanted to see the Hound die, is just horrible.
Yeah, agreed.
Ugh, Jesus.
Yeah. Is this when you guys realised that Beric was some kind of Firewhite? Thoughts on the chapter? I think for me, the big talking point here is Arya wants to get a confession out of Sansa. She wants to get him killed for his crimes. People are throwing a fuck ton of crimes at him that have been committed by various people. He pleads effectively his innocence. How innocent do you think Sansa is?
So he already admits, like, I think in the previous book, that he killed his first man at 12. So, he rejoices in, like, battle. And again, I don't know how he's been able to kill his first person when he's 12 and he's supposed to be, like, what, 25 in the books? Even though, like, all I see is Rory McCann, who plays him awesomely in the show, but that's the show. Like, who the fuck did he kill at 12 and he got away with it?
But, I mean, Arya killed someone.
Yeah, but Arya's at least of a high house, so it'd be like, oh, she killed a stable boy. All right, well.
Presumably he would have killed someone not very important in this world, so.
Yeah, I feel exactly. Like the son of a lord can, even if they're sort of newly raised to being a lord, they can probably get away with, if they killed a peasant, they probably wouldn't be in too much trouble in the Democratic Republic of Westeros.
I mean, who could be, you know, God knows. I mean, the impression that I get of Sandor is that maybe his first kill was an accident sort of thing. It was sort of a reaction or a fight that got out of hand with a smaller or something. And maybe it went south and then he got his reputation because of that. Who knows?
So, some guy's like, hey, look at your face. It's all half fucking burned away. And Sandor's like, motherfucker.
Your face looks like a mudslide. What are you doing?
Your face is atrocious. It's just god awful.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it would have been. Maybe he was a squire and there was a battle and he slew someone. I don't know what kind of battle it would be. Would it be around the same time as the Greyjoy Rebellion?
No, that's why I feel the timings, it would have lined up to be a much smaller incident. Who knows? Right. We might get it.
Yeah, I mean, it could just be him fighting with someone in the streets. Who knows?
That's why, literally, like, what the fuck is going on in Westeros, where, like, people are becoming great war leaders, like Jaime Lannister. It's like, what war happened besides Dagon's Rebellion? Like, how, like, is everyone just fighting each other? And, like the wardens are like, well, you know, it's fine. It's cool. It'll happen. Like, where Sandor's, like, killing people at 12.
Yeah.
What do you guys think? Is it known, or what do you think Sandor was doing prior to this, aside from getting drunk? Does he have any influence in anything that's gone on, or is it just...
I think he's a quite sort of nihilistic man for hire.
He's definitely not looking towards Lannisters for help, because he ran the fuck away during Blackwater. And even later on, they're like, oh, is this the puppy that got, like, the kid in the fucking inn? He's like, is this the puppy that was scared by fire? It's like, okay. Yeah, you want to say that to this hard fucking man that's going to, like, murder you.
Is it mentioned how the Mad Huntsman catches him in this chapter?
Oh, well, I found him while he was drunk. Like, yeah, reeling drunk.
It wasn't so much a capture as a mere rounding up, effectively.
I think he's a bit similar to Jaime in the sense that they sort of experienced this traumatic thing when they were younger. I mean, Jaime was older, but they sort of see the hypocrisy of the world, and Jaime's kind of tormented by it. You know, he describes that conflict to Catelyn when he's saying, you know, what do you do when...
Oh, you've gone again, Valkyrist.
I'm gonna just interject there, and I agree. I mean, the only difference is that it happened to Sandor when he was very young, and Jaime kind of grows up and discovers this as he grows older. And it's very interesting to see how actually two similar men with extremely different backgrounds and experiences and horrors that they've done can end up the same way and thinking in such a similar vein of thought almost. And with regards to the autocracy around them.
He's basically the broken man, and he's lost whatever things made him civilized, and now he's on a descent. That's all I had to say.
And yet the irony being that both he and Jaime are often by far the most empathetic, the most clear-sighted, the least tolerant of bullshit, and the most straightforward and rational. I mean, at other times they're utter shits too, but...
They loathe hypocrisy, I think. And Jaime even expresses admiration for the Hound, which is interesting in book four.
I think the Hound would be a fantastic POV to have.
I think so, but I also like getting different points of view from Sansa and Arya. I think their relationship and how they play off against him is quite interesting.
Certainly. It's definitely contrasting.
Indeed.
You know, you have a father-son relationship and a husband and wife relationship, because we all know Sansa's going to happen.
All right.
Speak truth. Bob, speak truth.
No, I didn't say
Stan San, so it's fine.
I kind of like both of those, actually.
Gross.
Why Stansa gross? Is it just the age
She's
gap?
She's like 11. She's 11 years old. He's like 30.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen
like
now.
She's 14 in dance.
Dude, some
it's
fucking...
still pretty gross.
Legal at
some
16.
Some fucking Lannister guy, like... Didn't he marry, like, a baby, and they make fun of him?
Yeah, and that's also pretty gross.
Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah, but just a minute. If someone is above the age of consent, which in my country is 16, and wants to get together with a 32-year-old, aren't we being ageist to say gross?
No, we're talking about a fantasy world where babies get married off to 15-year-olds. What? So do we not have any sort of origin on the Mad Huntsman or his future... potential.
I don't know who he is or what he is, but he has a bunch of dogs that like someone saw, like they tore a bear apart, but he's just
I'm not sure how much people who he is previously matters. I think it's more like, do you think he's gonna have any potential influence on the story?
I don't know that.
Is he with Stoneheart now, for example, with Jaime and Brienne?
I don't think he's been.
Yeah, I think that'd be the most likely one, because when the Brotherhood split, there was sort of the civilized part and then the ruthless, revenge-seeking part.
But that's it. They split away, and who knows, he could be more of the civilized branch.
I don't know. He seemed pretty down for some carnage against the Lannisters.
Yeah, and also he was hanging people in crow's cages, which apparently is against Lord Beric, which I don't really understand how Beric Dondarrion really got control of everyone and kind of dictates what happens throughout this like burnt landscape that is the Riverlands. But
I think maybe he represents the undecided middle of any democratic election.
He fights for the small folk, and there's a lot of small folk.
Yeah, the people in between who just kind of decide on the day and think, fuck it, I'll vote for him.
It's interesting. You say that with the High Sparrow as well. You can assume pretty decent amount of power if you appeal to the small folk.
The High Sparrow is basically the Trump of Westeros.
That's Howland Reed you're talking about.
No, because the High Sparrow seems to have some kind of competency and surrounds himself by people.
Yeah, he's way too efficient and confident.
It's true. I've never heard of the High Sparrow playing golf.
At his own golf.
Or making silly tweets.
He's
sending out stupid even ravens. Oh, let's fucking send this one to the Mormons. They don't like this shit.
Your name is Bear Island.
Sad. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Cool.
I mean, we don't have to have much more to say in this chapter because, again, I think like RO5 shit happens, right? It's plot filled. It's not a sort of introspective chapter in some. Okay, so should I close out the episode?
Yes, please.
It's probably better.
Okay, right. I want to thank everyone for joining the podcast. So Noah, Joe, and Tanya, the authentic Cockneys, Duncan, the visiting Cockney, and Matt, the Cockney ringer. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The Cockney what?
Ringer, a dead ringer, like you put in a ringer. It's like a fake.
We call them beg friends in England.
What?
Anyway.
What the fuck is going on?
Someone's making hot pockets.
House on fire?
You have
Thank
to spend
you very
this...
much for hosting, Bino.
You're welcome, Noah. I feel like Vali has spent this entire episode in a state of deep confusion, both about this world and Westeros.
And we haven't spoken about football once.
Exactly.
Oh, why'd you have to bring it up, Noah?
Soccer?
Yes.
Football.
If you are following along at home, which I hope you are, the next episode chapters are going to go from the 18th to the 29th of November. It's going to cover Tyrion 4, the first A Feast for Crow chapter we're doing, which is Aeron 1/The Prophet, Arya 7 and Arya 8. So it's a whole bunch of Arya, and I'm kind of excited that it's the first ever Feast for Crows chapter. It feels like, you know, this podcast is all grows up. And with that, I just want to just check if anyone has any other VOC episodes they want to pimp out, anything coming up that you're recording. I know that on next weekend, some of us are doing an episode on the 5-year gap and George's choice not to pursue that and what implications that might have had for narrative and character. But anything else? Yeah, I'm hoping so. Anything else going on?
I'm hopefully doing Kraken Cast Game of Thrones reviews. We won't do every week, but hopefully a couple episodes will do. So if you're in that part of the world, Australia, New Zealand, East Asia, and you want to jump on to a civilized time, just let us know in the thread. And I also want to do a William Gibson podcast. If anyone's read those cyberpunk books like Neuromancer or Burning Chrome, if you're interested, we're hopefully trying to do a podcast for that.
We did a Sense8 podcast on Wednesday. That'll hopefully be released soon. And I'm really desperately hoping, and there might be enough to talk about for us to do a second one at some point.
Well, first, Dragon Cast came out this week, and we'll probably be doing one every, maybe released every Tuesday during the season.
That was so intimidating. It came out before I'd even watched the episode.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, it came out really quickly, didn't it? Yeah.
It was very, yeah, very good.
Adam is on his game.
You've upped the ante.
Sure, not to spoil. It's going to be a good season, and... Can we just talk about the fucking not a blog thing that you posted today?
Should we maybe talk to Noah and Joe about whether they have upcoming podcasts first?
Sure.
No.
Fine.
So Noah and Joe, when are we doing a pre-season and last season wrap-up soccer cast where we talk about the Premier League and the Champions League? And
Bina, I am so down. Our most unsuccessful season in 20 years, where we win a trophy, a big, juicy, sexy trophy, and your most
tournament that nobody cares about.
Hang on. Your most successful season in about 1,000 years. I mean, I think dragons were still flying around when Spurs last did anything. And you...
Was that a burn?
It was a great
I don't know.
I mean, it's out facts, but never mind.
Varley, I've already dubbed you an honorary Arsenal fan. Your shirt's okay. In the post.
I'm in. Teach me the song.
Sweet. He's claimed. He's tainted now. He's mine. but you know, I'm so down for a season review. I think what I was going to suggest actually is for any of you listeners out there who are English or have, unlike Varley, have some knowledge of English football, then I think you should join our fantasy league, and I'm going to set that up in the next week or two. Get your teams in, and I'll put the code on the forums, and let's get this shit going.
Yeah. You should try to. Yeah, English hosts of podcast of Ice and Fire to go on, because then you could be on a actual podcast of Ice and Fire episode if you win the league.
That is an incentive for me to cheat, that is.
Okay, so let's do, I want to finish this in 2 hours. So you now have just under 3 minutes to vent about George basically not writing the book we want him to write.
But we're going to get two history books before.
No one gives Targaryen a shit. History books. No one cares. Yeah.
God. Okay, so we're going to get the history of the Targaryens before we get Winds of Winter. He says he's still fucking months away from finishing, if that is even true. I don't trust him. I don't believe him.
I mean, months can be any number of months. This can be like 100
37 months away, yeah.
That's yeah.
True.
So I think Joe had a calculation on how long he has left to publish it so that we can read it this year.
Well, I don't know if any of you go on the Song of Ice and Fire subreddit, but there's a guy called Brendan Beefish who's been tracking the number of days he has left in 2017 to finish it before it could be published in 2017.
I mean, he said it's not going to be right. I mean, exactly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That feels pretty redundant now. Right. Since we're waiting for a 2022 publication date now.
The way I look at it is, he's publishing volume one of Fire and Blood next year. He has to write volume two. That maybe comes out in 2022, and then he's going to get to T-Wow because he doesn't give a shit.
Do we know if Elio and Linda are going to be doing those books?
Because he didn't mention them. He didn't mention them.
Yeah.
And they haven't posted anything.
I did post on the forums that a podcast of Ice and Fire is doing a guy's night out, and Elio might be there. And I said, ooh, like, doing anything with George? Can they talk about it? Like, is that a thing that is, you know... So I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Varley, I think what we need is a Patreon to get you to fly out there and get Elio really fucking drunk, and then he'll chat about everything.
That would be a good
definitely.
Idea. I only nominate you because you're probably closer cost wise. So you know, a little cheeky. I would chip in.
Isn't he in like Sweden or something?
Oh, that's us.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah, you're... we can send.
We're
Patrick.
Sending Noah.
We should send Patrick.
Oh, Patrick, yes. Send Patrick.
Aunt Noah.
She said Peter. We should bring him out of retirement. Send Peter.
Oh, yeah. That would be fantastic.
And just with his voice and will, he'll extract all the information.
He'll make it happen. Yeah,
yeah. Take him into the woods. Feed him fermented beaver or something. Get his lips going.
I'll feed them Blood of Joe because he's a green seer.
Yeah, there you go.
I would say maybe Valkyries, maybe a little stop off in Copenhagen, and you can go and
connect him flight, nudge. Yeah, get him to the airport bar.
Yeah, who knows?
What are you actually doing in England?
What are you doing here?
Who are you? I had a uni conference in Lancaster, but I've also made it into like a holiday because it takes like two days to get here basically from Australia.
And
I've never been to the UK.
To visit us.
There was all these.
And I wanted to meet you guys.
That was the main reason.
That was an absolute pleasure, by the way.
Yeah, it was great. Went for like 6 hours.
Dude, and then you had lunch with Jed and watched the season premiere?
Yeah. So we had lunch on the Sunday, but then Jed mentioned he was having a viewing party for the first episode, and I had no way of watching it except on my phone. So I decided to, went down to where he lives outside London, had cooked dinner for everyone, which was delicious. And then we went on a walking tour of Jack the Ripper last night with Tanya.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Really?
Yeah, it was great.
Isn't it great that we're not like really secretly psychopaths and that when we meet
you'll never know until you come.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Dina's in Boston, and she's met all the American psychopaths, so...
They're vetted, like, yeah. So, yeah. Bean is
the awesome exception.
In so many ways.
The rest of us are extremely scary nut jobs. True, especially Joe.
Night jobs?
Nut jobs.
Oh,
but not an expression you have.
I mean, I get it now that it's nut jobs and not night jobs. But
okay. Okie dokie. So on a scale of anger to despondency, where do you all sit with relation to George?
Because I'm over gave up it.
Years ago.
I don't care. Just all I care when is it Winds of Winter is being real. Sorry.
So can you remind me on this post? I feel like I saw the one on the 14th of July where he was.
It was today.
About something else.
No, he's basically said we're not getting a book. We're not getting a book until 2018, but that's a different book. We may still get Winds of Winter in 2018, but fuck it, probably not.
Probably not.
Cool. I think what worries me is he seems to be referring to the Winds of Winter as like a first draft still, whereas like ideally you'd want it to be edited and rewritten a few times, revised a few times. You don't want the first draft.
No, he's still writing it. It's very clear. Only is he still writing it, but that whenever he starts writing it, he finds something else that he wants to write more. And that if you think about at the start of this year, he said, we'll probably get it this year, 6 months later. Now he's saying 2018. It always moves out. It's always 9 months away.
I agree with you. But do you know what? Because of everything that's come out, because of his procrastination, as it were, I'm fine with it. And I feel like if any writer is going to approach this in a sort of Brandon Sanderson type vein, they're gonna approach it and they're gonna be like, oh shit, he's got like 80% of it done, he just couldn't, you know, tie the knots and finish it off. Because I think it's just a fresh pair of eyes maybe that would need to just tie it all together and bring it to the fold, because he's already written all of the histories, he's getting it completely immersed in that. Like I just feel like he's got so much there, and it's maybe just a hesitancy of the absolute enamor that people have for him and the absolute fame that he's reached because of it.
I mean, I think the problem is like people like Bina that decided not to watch the show, that will never get a conclusion to this story.
How are we bastardized... the problem all of a sudden?
Oh, because Bina's always the problem. Come on.
How would that affect his writing, though, people not watching the show?
No, just that it's not affecting his writing. It's just that we'll never get a conclusion to the story.
No, we will, but just not in his
no,
words.
No, we won't.
It will be a you know, someone else will fill in.
He'll be a ghostwriter, clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he isn't going to finish
well,
it.
Well, no, because he's already like dictated like any of his notes should be burned. Like, he doesn't want anyone doing fan.
Well, you know, if he has done that, and I didn't realize that the case, then he's a cruel bastard, and I just disown him. That's just a really shitty thing. That's a really shitty thing to do to his fans.
Even more reason to get Elio and Linda drunk and send us out there so we can find this shit out now and let the people know.
Pops, that's up to you, man. You're closer.
I need a wingman.
Fuck. Okay, so this is the first VOK Patreon request ever. Enough money.
Fund our pub crawl.
That we haven't used to anything.
Yeah.
We're gonna send out two drunk stalkers, effectively.
That's
of,
right.
of great contributors to the world of Ice and Fire, shall we add?
Kickstarter. Kickstarter roofie Elio.
We're sending blood and cheese out there, and we're going to strong arm them into thinking.
Yeah,
into
we want to hire
us what's going on.
We want to hire some gangsters. Can you please fund our Kickstarter?
Well, yeah, what's interesting is though those two Fire and Blood history books weren't meant to be published until after the entire of Song of Ice and Fire was written. So those have been brought forward for some reason, which must be that he's struggling to get the main series done.
He's clearly got bogged down in all of these side stories with the Magor story, and with maybe potentially another Duncan Egg coming out. Who knows?
Well, he wanted to do 7 Duncan Eggs. Like, he has ambition to write in this world. He just can't finish this fucking story.
Well, I think Duncan Egg is much easier because there's a lot less time between when you start writing and when you finished it. There's like less writing before you get an output. And for Winds, there's so much writing that has to go into getting this output. And it's probably just not, I don't know, he just doesn't enjoy it.
I think Tanya is absolutely right. This is not a priority for him, and he doesn't have an obligation to us that it should be a priority, but it sucks that it isn't.
I saw a post, someone put something up that was on Not a Blog 10 years ago yesterday, where he says that in 10 years' time, people won't be annoyed about how long it took me to write the books. They'll just be happy to have the books. That's what got me when I saw that.
In that vein of thought, actually, in a serious note, I think the reason why the fandom and everyone is so furious and so anxious and everything is because I think we...
Oh, you cut out.
Maybe it's one of those things where there wasn't a conclusion. So. No, he got out.
Lack of payoff, it's a metaphor.
Sure.